to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Landon Mayer, and he'll be answering your most important questions on sight fishing for trout. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're going to be broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Landon a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Landon Mayer about sight fishing for trout. Keating's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California, features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 800-400-0359. Before we introduce Landon, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Landon's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away, thanks to Landon, a copy of his new book, which is Sight Fishing for Trout. And it's published by Stackpole Books. So what a great gift to win tonight, and here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something that Landon and I talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen carefully and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Landon's book. Well, tonight our guest is Landon Mayer. Landon is a fly fishing guide in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and he calls the South Platte River his home waters. He's been guiding on these waters for the past 12 years, as well as 1 year in Alaska with Nakmek Anglers. Passion and love for the sport of fly fishing is what motivates Landon. His success in catching trophy trout is fueled by an addiction of pursuing large trout with small flies and lightweight fly fishing equipment. Landon also displays enthusiasm in teaching and demonstrating his techniques and on-river knowledge to fellow anglers. Through trial and error and perseverance, he has developed innovative techniques for hooking and landing selective trout. He's sharing these techniques and secrets in a book called How to Catch the Biggest Trout of Your Life, published by Wild River Press, and his DVD, Landing the Trout of Your Life, featuring John Barr, produced by Mad Trout Media. And he has recently published his new book, titled Sight Fishing for Trout, by Stackpole Books. Landon Mayer is a contributing writer for High Country Angler magazine and major publications such as Fly Fisherman and American Angler. He is currently teaching several fly fishing classes and gives presentations on his techniques. Landon is an ambassador for Cloudvale Fly Fishing Apparel and a member of Ross Reels and Rio Pro staff. Well, Landon, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Roger. It's a pleasure to be on, and look forward to answering any questions anglers out there have about sight fishing for trout. It's definitely a passion I'm very fond of, and pursuit of larger fish and just quality fish. And I hope the interview today is able to help anglers in the future and be successful.
Well, I think it can only help because so many people have problems with this. So I think there's a lot of anxious anglers out there ready to learn a few things tonight. So that'll be great.
Absolutely.
Let's just start out by, you know, what, I mean, it may seem obvious, but what is sight fishing to you?
Well, sight fishing for me is everything from beyond locating the fish. I think a lot of people refer to sight fishing as finding fish in the water the most common way to do this is locating rising trout, but sight fishing starts from finding water to look into, watching the trout during the fight, locating areas where you can make presentations, learning new presentations, learning new rigs. Everything you do on the water can be a visual experience, and the new book I just had published with Stagpool, that's the reason for writing the book, is because it's played such a huge part in my success in guiding other anglers and success of my own on many waters throughout the U.S. for selective trout. So I think it's locating the fish, knowing your presentation counts every time, and it's just beyond wishful thinking.
Yeah, now I think some of the, you know, we all taught and guides say look for the trout, fish to the fish, that kind of thing. But it's easier said than done. And one of the things that we've got a lot of questions on is, I think where people start is, hey, I've got a problem. Maybe I don't have the right kind of sunglasses or something like that. So we got several questions here. Paul in California, Rick in California, David in Texas, Larry in Wyoming, Justin in Colorado, all asking about sunglasses or eyeglasses of different tints. So can you kind of run through that and tell us, you know, what lenses you should have, and if you should have different lenses depending on, you know, the light and so forth?
Yeah, that's a great question, and probably one of the most important questions when you're dealing with gear and proper apparel for being successful. When I'm choosing a pair of glasses, I always look for a frame that molds to my face is the first and most important thing. And more of the trend lately for fly fishing apparel with glasses has been thicker side shields, and what that does is reduces glare coming in from the side of your eyes. So instead of having to cup your eyes with your hands with thick side shields and a proper mold to where they fit snug to your face, you can look into the water without the distraction of having to squint and take away from your peripheral focal vision. And in addition to that, with the questions that are being asked about lens color, I prefer copper and brown, and I like mirrored lenses because I believe mirrored lenses bounce back the reflection that's coming up to your eyes. But copper and brown are light enough for dark days, yet dark enough for light days. And one of the biggest challenges anglers have when they get on the water is sometimes they'll have gray glasses, which are often too dark to locate a silhouette or an image of a trout, or they'll prefer to use an amber glass, which is sometimes too light to see colorations or too light to see the silhouettes. And one thing to always remember is if you change your lenses throughout the day by different glasses or different lenses within one frame, every time you look through a different tint, you're locating a different object, so your confidence decreases because you're having to look for that new target every time you put a new color on. So copper and brown tend to be the equal medium between, to where it's good for light days, it's good for dark days, and situations in the summer, for example, where you have bluebird skies in the morning and the storm system rolls in the afternoon, we all know that the light conditions in the morning are awesome for seeing fish, and then when the clouds come in, things get darker. So being able to have one lens that can accomplish both light situations is great.
Yeah, so I'm sure that's helpful for everybody to know that they don't have to really go out and buy two pairs, because for me it's always a big deal because I wear prescription. So that gets pretty darn expensive when you're trying to, you know, double up on different colors. So copper or brown will really do you good all day then.
Yeah, they'll do well, and it's copper is the color. If you look through the copper lens and you like the color and it's easy on your eyes, or if you try the brown and the brown's easy on your eyes, it's the best way to shop for glasses without question is to definitely go into the shop and try them on to make sure that they fit properly. And companies like the one that I'm sponsored with, Smith Optics, they go to great lengths to make sure that their prescription glasses, their frames, the models they come out with accommodate anglers' requests, and they're trying to make it easier for anglers to see fish, as we know how difficult that can be at times. So I definitely would say those two lens colors with the thick frame are the way to go.
Now, so the frame is actually on the newer models actually wrapping around, rather than...
Yeah, it's a wraparound, so it's thick from the lens in front covering the eyes, and it goes thick all the way and then tapers to skinny once it reaches your ears. And that way you'll have an inch to 2 inches of side shields that will literally mold to the side of your face with the proper fit. And many companies like Smith Optics will do medium, large, so they fit different shaped heads. And when you have that, you don't have to worry as much about light reflecting into the side to where you start squinting or cupping your eyes,
right,
and taking away from what you're viewing.
And they're making mirrored versions of the copper and brown too, right?
Yes, yes, yeah. The two I use from Smith, and there's other great companies out there as well that provide many different models, but I use Shelter for plastic lenses, and I also use Hideouts for glass lenses. And there's a difference between glass and plastic that goes beyond the make and quality of the lens, and that is the most important thing, is how comfortable you are in the water. Some people will put on glass lenses and fish all day, and by the end of the day, they'll have a headache because of the weight of the glass on their nose or the side of their ears. And in those situations, that's where a plastic lens, which is lighter, is not as heavy on your face, because if you get a headache, the biggest thing is it takes you out of the zone, so you don't see as many fish because you're not as focused and honed in on what you're doing.
Okay, now I haven't actually seen your new book yet, but I noticed that you had just mentioned the zone, and I noticed that's part of your book. Do you want to talk about what you mean by the zone?
Yeah, in the zone is similar to what athletes deal with as well. When you get to the water, the biggest thing to get into the zone is every time you approach a situation where you're going to make a cast or you approach the river in general when you first get to the water, the first and most important thing to get into the zone is just start looking before you fish. And by doing that, you start building up repetitive motion to where every run you go into, you'll get down into a position or get into a position where you can see fish clearly, and you'll actually watch the trout or watch the water to look for the fish before you start fishing. And what that does is allow you to see more because you're concentrating on looking instead of just concentrating on the cast and making a presentation.
I think that's what many of us do, is we're, you know, when we don't fish 200 days a year like you do, when we get out there, we're excited and want to get the line wet, right? And so we kind of move past what you just talked about many times. I know I do, and even though I know it's the wrong thing, but it just happens. But when do you start looking for fish then? As you come up on the water, you know, are you 50 feet away starting to look for fish, 100 feet away? When do you start?
Yeah, I think you start looking for fish when you first actually see water. The part of sight fishing which is so great is sight fishing isn't just about always locating the trout. Before you locate the trout, some of the questions that are going to be answered tonight will be about this as well, but you're always going to try to locate water where you think fish are holding, so I think it starts right away. I mean, the first thing in the back of my mind whenever I approach a water with clients or myself is, from days of old, I always loved rising trout and fishing dries, so I look for a rise form, or if I can't see fish rising, I'll look for water that I think has three key ingredients, which is cover, oxygen, and food supply. And it'll start from there, and then once I start getting closer to the water to where I'm actually on the river's edge, the first and most important thing I do is I always look at my feet and then start spreading my eyes towards the other bank, because a lot of fish love to hug the banks, especially when they're in situations that they're dealing with many predators or pressure from anglers walking above.
Yeah, now I've heard, I don't know where I heard this, but it might have been from one of your friends who said they'd watch you go up a stream and looking for maybe a quarter or a half mile before you even wet your line, just scoping out the river and so forth. Is that true? Do you spend that much time looking at times?
I do. And the reason for that is because I'm looking for the unobvious. Instead of looking for a detailed image of the trout, I'm looking for silhouette shapes, coloration, maybe the tip of a trout's tail. In addition to that, what I'm trying to do is to locate fish that I know are actively feeding, because some fish are simply sulking and staging at the bottom of a run, or some fish are spooked. But my philosophy on fishing, especially when you're looking for trout or you're hunting trout, one of the best ways to be successful when you're trying to catch larger fish or more quantities is to cover more ground so that you're not stuck in the rut of being in a particular run for a long period of time, because eventually the fish become wise to movement from above or on natural objects moving through the water. And that's really one of the beauties of the South Platte River and many rivers throughout the U.S. is there's many sections of public water that can span 1 mile, 100 yards, or 5 or 6 miles long. But if you cover the water thoroughly, you'll leave at the end of the day knowing that you've given it your all, you've looked for every fish possible, and that's really how you find the unpressured willing trout that will take the fly over fish that are pressured and are harder to catch.
If you, and this gets, I want to ask this now just because you brought it up, but because we're going to talk about presentation later and so forth, but just working an area. If say you've spotted a good lie for a fish and you're pretty darn sure, maybe you've even seen some movement down there and spotted a fish, how long will you spend there before you move on, given what you just said about, you know, spending too much time there, they're going to know about you eventually. So how much time do you give a spot before you move on?
That's a great question. I usually give it around, I would say, 10 to 30 minutes tops. And the way I base that is, the first and foremost, is the trout's behavior. The fish remains feeding. I'll continue to try to catch the fish. In addition to that, if the fish is not eating on the surface, then what I'll do is develop a tier system to where I start light and I gradually work my way down. So I'll start 2 to 3 inches below the water surface if fish are hanging in the film. If fish are holding in the middle of the run, I'll work my way down to their depth and using different presentations so that I know the fish have covered every inch of the water, but at the same time I haven't pressured the water enough to where the fish will spook or the fish will stop feeding. Because sometimes trout are willing to come up to take a food source. They're willing to move side to side. And they're willing to do this a lot of times beyond what anglers would commonly think a trout's movements would be. Instead of sipping a fly, sometimes the fish will come up and eat a fly 2 feet from the bottom of the water, or they'll move to the left 4 feet to come over and hit a fly. So I would say 15 minutes is a good general time frame, knowing that I've covered different depths and covered different areas of the run. If the fish are there and they're still feeding, I'll stay longer. If the fish feel wary or they're doing movements based on me being there that shows that they're wary or spooked, then that's when I'll continue up or downstream.
Okay. A couple questions here, and we just got one on the Internet. Just Scott from Denver, he says, Landon, why do I stink so bad at sight fishing? And some of the other, couple other questions, Dan in Bismarck and Chuck in Santa Rosa, California, both kind of asked, how come the guides always can see fish and us mere mortals can't?
Well, it goes back to, if you think about what you do for a living, like you mentioned earlier, we are in the water a lot. So while some anglers are working during the week in front of a computer screen, they're used to seeing that. We're used to seeing water. But the biggest advantage there is to practice. And I think the way that anglers can become better at sight fishing for trout when they're on their own is to locate images to where you become comfortable focusing and refocusing your eyes. So what we're looking at as we're walking up or downstream is we're focusing on the river bottom. And what we're looking for is anything unnatural from the river bottom. So we're comfortable because we see that water a lot.
Yeah, so it's, you know, when there's something different. It's,
you're
out of the ordinary, and then that catches your eye, I suppose.
Absolutely, yeah. You focus on the river bottom, and you do this to where the river bottom becomes the focus, and then your peripheral vision widens. And as you move upstream, the refocus is where you focus on a trout, and then your focal vision comes into play to where you look at the object. If it is a fish, then you'll cast to it or you'll get in position to make a presentation after you look at it first. If it's not a trout, then we'll refocus to scanning the river bottom and continuing upstream. And I think the key there is to know that the river bottom is the focus, not the surface of the water, so the distraction of glare or movement on the water surface doesn't come into play. So it goes back to the same mentioned before about my first book. You look at one of those three-dimensional pictures and eventually the image comes out and comes clear and you can see it within the picture. That's the same thing you want to do going past the distraction from the water surface or glare.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose the other thing about guides that I can think of is when you go out with a guide, the guide isn't fishing. All he's doing is looking. So every time
true.
He goes out guiding, he's looking, not fishing. So he gets a lot of darn practice doing that.
Absolutely, and that goes back to what we just spoke about a couple minutes ago, and that is if you look, if you take the time within an hour, if you take 15 minutes out of each hour of the day that you're fishing and you look more, I think more anglers are becoming aware of the fact that there are fish in front of the runs that they would conventionally dead drift or run flies through without looking. By looking into the run and investigating the run, they'll start seeing more fish. And That's really what guides are trying to do when they're on the water, is locate fish for their clients to be successful. And the reason for my newest book and many of the teachings is for that as well. So definitely looking while you're fishing or looking before you fish is definitely key.
Yeah. Well, we need to take a quick break here, Landon, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Landon Moore about sight fishing for trout. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Landon Mayer about sight fishing for trout. If you'd like to ask Landon a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And I did get a message online here about a question of where's the registration link on the homepage. If you're on the homepage, just go ahead and refresh that page, and the link will magically appear. So sorry about that, but I fixed that while we were talking here, and everything should be good to go. Okay, Landon, before we get back into sight fishing for trout, tell me a little bit about what's happening in your fly fishing world and about your business and your new book and so forth.
Absolutely. Well, the new book just came out 2 months ago. As you mentioned, it's with Stack Pool Books, and it's on sight fishing for trout. The reason for the book is to cover a subject that has actually never been published before in our industry, and I feel so strongly about the technique of sight fishing and the whole aspect of sight fishing that I've spent a year and a half developing the book, and it's a visual learning tool. So as you flip through the book, it's page after page of photographs of trout actually holding in the water, and then if you flip to the following page, there's the same picture with the circle around the fish. So you're seeing the silhouettes, the objects, and the coloration that guides are seeing, or a lot of the experienced sight fishers are seeing in the water. So it'll build confidence for you when you're out there. And beyond the book, I've been doing a lot of speaking. I just recently came back from Hickory, North Carolina, and I've been traveling around with the International Sportsman's Expo and AFTA. I'm working on my third book project at the moment, which will be released in September 2011. That's Colorado's Best Fly Fishing. And I'm raising my 5-year-old daughter and enjoying another season to come of hopefully quality experiences on a day-to-day basis with clients and just enjoying every aspect of the sport.
Well, one of the areas that you fish a lot is called the Dream Stream. And actually, Chris in Lakewood put in a question or kind of a comment here online. And he says, have you been there recently? And he says, that's a great place to fish. Just wondering if the Lake Run Rainbows have entered the river yet.
Well, good question. I was actually on a trip today. I was on the Dream Stream, and fish are starting to move. This year we've had a colder season, so our January and February have felt more like December, and the weather is going to be increasing more and more, so we're seeing flows right now of 80 CFS, and today's temperatures are, I believe, in the 40-degree mark. So to answer the question, we are seeing some fish, but I do believe that it's going to continue to get better through the course of March and through April into the summer months. And whenever you have a situation where migrating trout have to wait and stage for the right conditions and the right temperatures, you start seeing large runs of fish and large pods of fish. So I think we'll see more numbers this year than we have in the last 2 years.
Now, we have people listening from all over the world to our show. Can you describe to the people what the, I know you work out at Colorado Springs, but can you describe people what the Dream Stream is and where it is in relationship to you in Colorado Springs and why it's important to you?
Absolutely, yeah. And people can also look at photographs and video footage from the Dream Stream on my website, landonmayer.com. And the Dream Stream is a section of the South Platte River. The South Platte River is broken up into five tailwaters. The unique thing about the river is it's broken up into sections to where every time you go to a new location, the run of the river, the make of the river is different. So it's like fishing five rivers wrapped into one. The DreamStream section is 3.5 linear miles long, 5.5 winding miles long. It runs below Spinney Mountain Reservoir in an open meadow, giant park. It's called South Park. And it flows downstream, snaking, oxbowing, and bending into 11 Mile Reservoir. And 11 Mile Reservoir is around 140 feet deep. So the fish migrate up into this narrow river, which is 15 to 30 feet wide. And you have the advantages of fly fishermen to encounter some of the largest trout in the U.S. in an up-close personal environment where you can see a lot of the fish. The fish, if they feel pressured or flows drop or something happens by man or nature, have the luxury of retreating back down to 11 Mile Reservoir. So it's all public. None of it's private. It's state and DOW land, and we were fortunate enough that they purchased and accomplished getting this land for all fly fishers in Colorado and beyond to use.
Terrific, terrific. Yeah, great place to go. And only what you were telling me earlier, just about an hour and 15, 20 minutes from Colorado Springs.
So. Yeah, hour and 15 minutes from the Springs is 2.5 hours from Denver.
Yeah.
And there's many reservoirs, Antero, 11 miles, Spinney Reservoir. And along the way is Cheeseman, Deckers, 11 Mile Canyon. Above that is Tomahawk. And it's just a giant playground in South Park. So it's a great place. If you haven't been there, then definitely worth the travels to come out and experience it.
Yeah. Pete Gramp in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. And I'm going to kind of paraphrase his question here, but he wants you to comment on whether you sight fish at known locations for trout or if you go exploring. And you've kind of talked about this already, but, you know, like, for instance, you fish the Dream Stream a lot. You probably know specific, you've done it so much, you know, that there's usual spots that fish are in. So does that make it easier to, and do they come back to the same spots? Is it easier to see them when you expect to see them?
That's an excellent question, and what it is that I'm looking for is when you're on the water, we're conventionally taught the basics, and the basics are looking for a run, deep water, where trout will hold and can get cover oxygen and food supply. One of the biggest things is walking and covering the water, what I call the in-between water, water in-between runs, looking in the structure, riffles, any location to where fish that would be holding in a deep run that could be pressured by predators or oftentimes by anglers will move up or downstream into unconventional areas. So we'll cover that water, not just walking in between the holes. We'll actually look further and fish more in between the runs and find more larger and larger quantities of trout.
So the not-so-obvious places, huh?
Absolutely. That's one of the keys. And the reason for that is just how many anglers are enjoying the sport. And trout are very wary by nature, and by doing so, they're masters of disguise. So even if there's one rock that's 3 feet tall, 4 feet wide, and it has an undercut that's only 18 inches tall, a 27-inch brown with a 16-inch girth is going to find refuge next to underneath that rock. And oftentimes, it's going to be in between the runs where the fish could become food for a bird of prey from above.
Is it easier to see a larger fish than a smaller fish?
That's a good question as well. It is easier to see larger fish than a smaller fish if you're in clear water settings or flat, calm water settings. On the flip side, if you're dealing with migrating fish, then the fish are oftentimes just coming from deep bodies of water, so they don't have any color on their body at all, and you're looking for silhouettes. But I wouldn't say that a smaller fish is easier or harder to see than a larger fish because all fish, whether they're 30 inches long or 13 inches long, are built for camouflage, and their camouflage is from the lateral line up. So while we're looking down at a 45-degree angle, the refraction of light will tilt that to where we're actually looking down 32 degrees towards their back. So even the largest fish can almost completely disappear if they sink down into a deep run and you lose them in the color, or if they're sitting in a riffled run with disturbance on the surface, which distorts the image below. But the nice thing about larger trout is the deeper they get in the water, the more magnified they are as far as their body and size, so the larger the image is.
Okay, okay. Pete in Kansas says, loved your first book, and he says, it's much easier to see from a cliff above. Any pointers on reading from standing in the water?
That's another good question. Standing in the water, it's harder to do because you're closer to the water's surface and you're not at a high angle. So if you are standing on a cliff, you can obviously see everything below. when you're standing in the water, the key there is to find proper viewing lanes or windows. So you want to locate the area of water up, downstream, or directly across from you that you can see the fish. When you're doing this, just make sure the biggest thing is to tread lightly. So you want to do what I call stealth wading. That's in the sight fishing book. You wait where you dive your toes, you slide, try to make yourself as invisible as possible and stay low to the water surface. When you are locating fish from that angle, the biggest thing to look for would be movement and coloration along with silhouette. When you're looking down at a fish, you see the fish's back. When you're looking at a fish from an angle to where you're standing in the water, then you have the luxury of seeing coloration, so you almost give yourself an advantage of silhouette, coloration, and movement, not just silhouette and movement from above.
Is there a better light angle for seeing into the water, you know, given behind you, you know, backlit, side lit? Is there
absolutely.
Yeah?
In sunny conditions, it's backlit for sure. You want the sun at your back, or you want the sun shining at an angle that's above you or slightly below you, which can oftentimes intensify the coloration of the fish when it's holding in a run, or can open up a viewing lane that wasn't possible earlier. But keeping sun at your back is very important. And then on the flip side, and the book goes into detail on this, during stormy conditions, the reflection of dark clouds on the water surface has the same effect as high noon suns or the sun at your back. So if you're dealing with cloudy situations, it's opposite. You want the clouds in front of you, so it's reflecting the dark or the black on the water's surface, which takes away the glare and then creates a viewing lane.
Okay, okay. We've got a couple questions coming in here. Sam T. from Athens, Georgia. Yeah, go ahead and register, Sam. Just put in your name and so forth, and that's fine. Let's see what else we got coming in here. This goes back to kind of how long you should fish an area. We've got someone that asks, if I spook a fish, how long should I wait till I go back to that hole?
Another good question. When you spook a fish, base it off how the fish moves. A fish that has not seen an angler oftentimes will dart out of the run and disappear, bolt up or downstream. That trout will come back to its feeding area faster than a fish that, let's say you spook a fish and it just drifts to the side, or you spook a fish and it sulks down to the river bottom. Those fish have often seen anglers and have been spooked before. So I would give a trout that bolts out of the run 15 minutes to 30 minutes before I come back to check it. If a fish just simply drifts away and acts like it's slowly moving away from the water where it became a prey for a predator above, then I would give it at least an hour, maybe an hour and a half before I came back, unless the fish are actively feeding and you see the fish return. So if you see the fish return and start feeding again, which can happen as fast as 5 minutes during a hatch, give it 15 to 20 minutes if the fish spooks right away. If the fish slowly spooks away, then give it an hour to an hour and a half.
Wow, yeah, that's very interesting. I've never heard that or knew that there was a difference between that, but it makes total sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because the trout that's seen you before gets accustomed to you. He still may... He may have his eye on you and know
right.
how to deal with you more, but he's not going to just run away because it costs him energy, too.
Absolutely, yeah. And when I wrote the book, Sight Fishing for Trout, it took a year and a half because I wanted to cover all the bases, and that's one of the very interesting detailed topics that many anglers haven't heard or thought of before, but there's different reactions in how fish spook, how fish feed versus breathing, and there's a lot of detailed information, so that's a really good question, and that's one thing to always remember when you're coming back to a run to fish your trout that has spooked out.
Now, give us a few examples of what you're looking for in the water. You talked about a silhouette, but what are some of the other things, the telltale signs of a trout feeding, or what other things are you looking for specifically?
You bet. I would concentrate on talking about the most important thing beyond a silhouette, and that is an object. When you're approaching water and you're in situations where the water is not clear or situations where the fish is very disguised and camouflaged from dirty water, deep water, disturbance on the surface, you then look for objects. When you're looking for objects, you want to look for the closest thing to the water surface, which is often the top of the dorsal fin, the trout's head, the tip of the trout's tail. In addition to that, when you are looking for color, don't look for the specific make of the color on the trout's body. For example, you may only see a quarter size red on a gill plate. That's the size of an apple on a rainbow, and that's a giveaway that you know the trout's holding in the water. And the most important thing to look for before you look for silhouettes or objects is the opening of the trout's mouth when it feeds. And when fish feed, it can be as subtle to where it's a sip, or when fish feed, it can be a large opening of their mouth. So you want to look for the white, the silhouette, and I'd say the best addition to that would be the objects. And sometimes the object is only 2 inches of the tail or 2 inches of the dorsal fin, but that plays a huge part in success for many anglers on the water, because then you know that you're casting to a target. It's not a guessing game.
And those objects you're talking about look different in comparison with the things around it, like a round cobblestone or something like that.
Absolutely, yeah, because a lot of times light slightly reflects through trout's tails and their fins, where their fins are somewhat translucent. Even when they're colored up, the color's magnified, or there's some penetration of light to where those become objects that look very different from the river bottom or from the water they're holding in.
Now here's, and we're going to talk about approaching fish here, so well, maybe I'll hold on to this one question here that just came in on the Internet. But let's move on then to talking about approaching fish. But before we do that, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll work on approach. So when we return, we'll talk with Landon Mayer more about sight fishing for trout. The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call the Platte River Fly Shop at 307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Landon Mayer about sight fishing for trout. If you'd like to ask Landon a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Landon, approach. Let me start this out, and this is a question that came off the Internet. Aaron in Atlanta, Georgia says, the idea of, if I can see him, he can see me. What is the trout's degree of vision, or what are trout's blind spots?
Good question. Blind spots for a trout, my belief, is directly behind the fish. And trout see in a cone vision. So if you can imagine an ice cream cone tilted up at a 45-degree angle towards the water surface, that's how a trout could see. The thing to remember about trout's vision is the closer they are to the water surface, the narrower their viewing lane. The deeper they are in holding in a run, the wider their lane becomes. So that ice cream cone is going to get thin, or it's going to widen, depending on how deep they're holding in the run. So that's the first thing you want to look for. If the fish is holding in shallow water or is close to the surface, you can get fairly close to the fish. If the fish is in deeper water, you want to give yourself distance of 5, 15, 20 feet, and always make sure you approach the fish from downstream so you're coming up on its blind side, which is directly behind the trout.
So I assume that you're, in many cases, when you present, you're doing some kind of hook cast, and if you can be downstream and hook above them and come right into them, that would be a good presentation technique?
It is a good presentation technique. In addition to that, if you can't hook a cast or you can't do a curb cast, just make sure that you're dealing with your presentations at 45-degree angles to where you're not casting directly over the fish. If you are slightly downstream, make your presentation 45-degree angle from either side of the river, so that way when your flies land, anything drifting over the top of the fish is going to be your leader, tippet, and flies, and your fly line is going to remain out of view. And one way to make sure that happens is to extend a 9-foot leader to a 12 or 13-foot leader so that you're casting more leader and tippet, which is often fluorocarbon. That's what I prefer to use, which is non-reflective of light, so the fish have less chance to spook.
Kevin in Columbus, Ohio says, I have Landon's book, which is excellent. can he give us some Midwestern fly fishermen advice on sight fishing? Specifically, how close to the fish can you get without spooking them?
The closest you can get to a fish without spooking it is definitely based on different watersheds, but I would say my general rule would be 10 feet is about as close as I want to get. In some situations, I can get within 5 feet of the trout. But knowing this, when you are approaching the fish, base it on the trout's behavior as well. So if the fish is actively feeding and you're at 10 feet away from the fish and you take that one step forward and you see an awkward motion or movement from the fish, take a step back, hunker down, let the fish get comfortable again before you make a presentation. But my general rule is 10 feet. If you can do 5 feet, it's usually in shallow water situations or when fish are actively feeding on the surface and they have a very narrow window for seeing anything from above.
Okay, so as they get closer to the surface, they see less of the surrounding
Absolutely.
Area above the water?
Absolutely, to where they can have a viewing lane, which is 4 inches wide if they're hanging 2 inches below the water's surface. So it can be very, very narrow. So that's a situation where you could get within 5 feet of the trout. The fish is holding deeper in the run, then their viewing lane can expand 2 or 3 feet. That's where you give yourself 10 feet so you have breathing room.
Very good, very good. Pete in Pottstown, Pennsylvania again asks, I'm 6'4" tall and wide in girth. Please discuss your methods for stealth when approaching water with obvious trout present.
The best way to do stealth is give yourself, first thing is to give yourself 3 options. If you're tall, as awkward as it may seem, the fish can definitely see you easier, but you have an advantage because you're viewing down more instead of viewing across. So you give yourself 3 options, and the 3 options, A, B, or C, have 1 or 2 of the options be on one side of the river and the other option being on the other side, to where you could approach from any one of those locations. This way you can devise a game plan on how to approach the fish, and you can go through your head mentally and think about where would be the best place to make a presentation, which one's going to spook the fish, which one would not spook the fish. In addition to that, if you're downstream from the fish and you want to approach the trout to where you're perpendicular to make a presentation, as an example, always think about walking wide to where you don't just walk directly upstream. If you have the option of walking wide to where you can go around, back away from the river, and then approach the river from above the trout, if that's where you want to present from, that's a huge advantage. In addition to that, how you wade is very important. Every step you take, the less vibration you make, the better off you are. Diving your feet, I mentioned earlier. In addition to that, when you're sliding in the river, instead of scraping your boots along the river bottom, which causes noise that can be felt on the trout's lateral line, try lifting your foot up 3 or 4 inches, slide it up to your next foot, and then plant it back down. Lastly, when you're talking about approach, always try to use high banks as viewing points and low banks as presentation areas. This will keep you closer to the water's surface, especially when you're dealing with height, and less fish will spook out of the runs.
Well, come to think of it, Landon, all the pictures I've seen with you, I don't know if I've ever seen a picture of you standing upright. I think you're either on your knees looking for a fish or on your knees landing a fish. So
yeah.
It just kind of dawned on me that you spend a lot of time on your knees.
You know, and that's the biggest thing is kneeling, and this is also in the book, kneeling is key. And when you're kneeling down, the key there is always on one knee so you can get up quickly. You can use your other knee as support. If you're on both knees, when you're down, oftentimes your legs get tired and they can give out. But there's many situations where, I mean, at times you can even get into a position where you're laying down flat on your stomach and making a presentation, or you may actually be down in the water to where the water's up to your chest, you're making a presentation. The only time you're really standing is to view, and whenever you're out of view by making a presentation from those low positions, it gives you a huge upper hand in making the fish take your fly.
Okay, good, good. Question from Brian, and he's from Ohio. But he said he was visiting in Colorado last week, fishing the South Platte at Deckers and also in Cheeseman. He said, we were able to get much closer to the fish on Friday in Deckers and almost exclusively sight fished to them. On Friday, we tried the same tactics in Cheeseman, but we seemed to spook a lot more fish. The weather on Friday was much warmer and sunnier, which pushed the water temp to near 45. Saturday was much colder and cloudy, with water temp barely breaking 41. Do you think the water temperature, weather conditions, or just the geography of the Rocky Canyon banks would have caused this?
The answer there is yes to all the above, and I'll explain real quick. Weather conditions play a huge part. The warmer the water gets, the more active the trout become in feeding. And when trout are feeding or migrating, they become more comfortable concentrating on what they're doing at the moment instead of becoming wary of predators. So the increase in temperatures definitely helped getting closer to the fish at Deckers. When cloud cover comes in, your viewing lanes decrease and things become difficult because the reflection of clouds on the water's surface creates more glare. So that probably didn't help as well. Cheeseman is often known for a very wary fishery, just like the Dream Stream is. And one of the things about Cheeseman, the geography, is everybody has to hike down to the trout. So when you are hiking down to the trout, that's where the fish become more wary and spooked. Next time you're fishing Cheeseman, or you have the chance to come up from Ohio and experience the water, or even on your home waters, look for areas where there's disturbance or chop. A good friend of mine, Pat Dorsey, who just published his second book, Tailwaters, is a firm believer in pocket water, and I'm a firm believer in riffles. And Cheeseman's a great display of that, because when you're fishing Cheeseman, if you're in a slick or deep pool where you can easily see the fish, they see so many anglers in movement from above that they simply get in there and will only feed when necessary. The trout in the riffled runs or the pocket water, where you often would not look for fish because it's fast and it's moving around multiple boulders, that's where you'll find most of your actively feeding fish, and you can get within 10 feet of where you're casting from to make the presentation.
So in his scenario, there's a lot of things going on. And on any given day and any given stretch of the river, things will be different, and I guess you have to adapt.
Absolutely, and that's where the visual game of sight fishing helps you learn as an angler and identify different things such as weather, lighting conditions, trout behavior. And if the angler, if Brian wasn't able to actually see the fish in Cheeseman or see the fish in Deckers, he wouldn't be able to ask the questions he just did. So good for him in knowing that he's taking the time to look for fish in the water.
Sam T. in Athens, Georgia asked, and they put this in online here, Landon. I fish streams small enough to jump across in North Georgia for native brook trout. Is sight fishing a viable option on these small streams?
It is a viable option where you can make sure that you're drastically increasing your angles. We deal with creeks here, for example, down in the Conejos River. The tributaries that lead into the Conejos have great fish, brook trout, brown trout, rainbows, and some cutthroats as well. And there's a lot of those creeks that are very, very narrow, 1 to 2 feet wide. And what we end up doing there is we actually feed line down to the fish to where you're making a presentation from above the trout. You start by looking downstream of the fish, locate the fish, and then use a marker on the river's edge. And then if you walk wide and move upstream and find the marker, because the water is so narrow, you don't have to worry as much about being on one side or the other side of the river. Make a presentation downstream while feeding line. And in the book, I demonstrate by photographs casting sequences. One of my favorite casts for this is the S-curve cast. You create curves in your fly line to where the first thing visible to the trout in that narrow water is your fly, nothing else. So there's no movement from above. There's no leader. There's no indicator. It's the first fly within the viewing lane. In addition to that, speaking of indicators, when you're dealing with fish in those tight quarters, try to eliminate any indicators at all. It's where you use a dry dropper situation and also eliminate split shot to where you could fish a bars emerger with a bead head below a visidon, or you can use a copper john below a BC hopper when you want to use a larger fly selection.
Now, let me just jump to this other question here, sorry. I'm trying to read these things online. We've got Duke in Ithaca. This kind of jumps back to seeing fish. He says, when you're trying to find a large trout, are you looking for different types of clues in different light? So cloudy or sunny days, morning versus midday or afternoon, water conditions. So you've addressed some of this, but he's actually asking, you know, are there clues you look for in the morning as opposed to the afternoon, or depending on light and so forth?
Absolutely. In low light situations where the light's at an angle, early morning, late evening, I'm looking for movement and I'm looking for coloration. Because the sun's glaring down, often at a 45-degree angle, it'll illuminate the trout's body more, so you can see more coloration or you can see more movement. The hardest thing to see in those low light situations is going to be the silhouette of the trout, because the glare is so drastic on the water surface, it's not a giveaway. In lighting situations where it's cloudy, when you're looking into the water, you're not going to be looking for silhouettes as much as you would be an actual detailed image of the trout. If you can't find the detailed image, then what I find in cloudy situations is objects. So I look for objects in cloudy situations because I know that the silhouette's going to be very difficult to see. I'll always look for the white of the mouth and the silhouette, but for low light, I look for coloration and movement. Cloudy situations, I look for objects more. And then in sunny situations or situations where I have drastic viewing lanes, that's where I begin looking for the silhouette. And one thing to always remember when you're dealing with the silhouette, the way I explain it to my clients is, if you were to take a picture of a trout and you draw the outline of the trout with a pencil or a pen, and then you color it in with colored pencils, that's a detailed image. If you take that same picture of a trout and you eliminate the outline pen or pencil drawing and you painted the fish with watercolors, that's a silhouette. So a silhouette's a very vague, it's either a vague hue of blue, green, tan, or brown. And a lot of times silhouettes are second-guessed by many anglers to where they're looking to run, and they may think it's a trout. A lot of times what you're thinking is a fish is actually the silhouette of a trout.
Okay. Okay. Now, let's talk about presentation here. And we've got some good questions on that. One came in on the Internet. Again, Sam, and Sam's an active little poster here on the Internet. He asks, when sight fishing to trout, how far upstream of the fish should you cast? So I guess he's saying, I spotted a fish, maybe I'm downstream from him, now I'm going to do my presentation. How far above that fish should I be casting?
Good question. You want to cast in shallow water, I usually do 3 to 5 feet. And that's usually water depths of 2 to 3 feet. And my rule of thumb is in shallow water, go a foot or two above. In deep water situations where a fish is holding in 5 to 7 feet of water, I'll go 3 to 5 feet higher. And the way to think about it is just always try to imagine the sinking ratio of your flies and try to imagine how your flies are drifting down to the fish in the water. So shallow water, give 2 or 3 feet if the fish is very shallow. It's 3 to 4 feet of water, extend that by 2 or 3 feet. And just base it on how fast the flies will sink to the fish and how the fish is reacting to them. So I would say, generally speaking, 3 to 5 feet shallow water, 5 to 10 feet in deep water.
And then the speed of the current? The
speed of the current is going to play a huge factor. And that's where what I discussed at the beginning of the interview, depth control is key. So while you're dealing with casting above the trout, I always start light, or I suspend my flies if I'm questioning depth to where the water is very slow. The lighter you are, the better off you are because the less snags you have. If you're in fast water and you're casting above the fish and you simply think you're drifting over the top of them, that's when you start working on that tier system to where you can add a split shot, get a little bit deeper, add a split shot, get a little bit deeper. Or on the flip side, if you're eliminating split shot, you can upsize the beads on the same size fly. So one of the tricks of the trade now is to take a size 18 pheasant tail with a tungsten bead and replace the split shot with beads to where you can have a 5/32nd speed, or sorry, 5/64 speed, a 3/32nd speed, and you can start increasing the size of the bead to replace the split shot so everything drifting downstream is natural.
So it sounds like your real preference is to go with the weighted fly rather than split shot.
Yes, if possible, and there are situations where that's accommodating, and there are other situations where it's not. I think where that's accommodating is where you're dealing with fish that you can see clearly based the reaction and their movement, or if you're dealing with water that I call the unknown, to where you're unknown how deep the water actually is that you're fishing. That's where you gradually work your way down. And when you're dealing with where each fish in general, by eliminating any unnatural objects, it's going to give you the upper hand for getting that fish to take your fly.
You said split shot.
on a couple of occasions. Have you ever tried, or what's your opinion on this? I think it's called Mojo Mud or the moldable weight.
Yeah, the tungsten putty or Mojo Mud. I think that's a preference. I believe that split shot sinks faster, so I have developed a tier system with split shot just by using it for many, many years. I believe it's the confidence. So if you have confidence to where you can take away or apply a close to approximate amount of putty, then if that's what you're comfortable with, go with it. The reason I prefer to not use putty is when you take putty away or you add putty to the fly or to your rig, you never know if you're applying the exact amount. So you could over-apply or under-apply, where when you're dealing with split shot, you know that you're dealing with size O, size 2, size 4, and size 6.
Exactly. Good point. Good point. Rick in Richmond, California asks, do you cast almost exclusively to sighted fish, or do you sometimes cast blind into structure or flow?
Definitely do both. I cast to fish that I can see, and I prefer seeing fish because I believe that they're the best target, not the indicator on your line or your leader. But I will cast into deep water where situations are supplying the fish with cover, oxygen, and food supply. And there are situations where you can't see fish because the water's too dirty, it's high and dirty. Or if you're fishing streamers in a deep, deep run, or you're fishing streamers in a wide, vast river, then I'll go back to fishing where I'm looking for fish. I'm still doing the visual game because I'm trying to sight water where fish are holding, so I'll go back to my basics. But while I'm doing that, I'm still keeping a visual keen eye and trying to see if I can locate a trout, locate a wake, locate a rise, locate anything that's going to let me know a trout is holding in the water. So I will do both, but I'm always looking for that target to be spotted by myself or anybody I'm fishing on the water with.
Great, great. Need to take another quick break here, Landon, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Landon more about sight fishing for trout. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on U.S. 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Landon Mayer about sight fishing for trout. If you'd like to ask Landon a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, backing up here a bit, John in Loveland, Colorado asks, you mentioned fluorocarbon leaders. Do you hand tie them or buy them? What's the general length that you use?
I do not hand tie them. I definitely buy them. I have hand tied them before. The situations where the situations where I hand tie is where I'm building a leader for a specific setup with a rig like a hopper copper dropper, where I'll build the leader to 4X to the hopper, and then I'll do 4X to the main, and then I'll do 5X to the dropper. Or when I'm fishing streamers, if I'm using OX, I'll use OX. If I think that's too thick, then I'll build to 1X, and then I'll build to 2X. And drop down the diameter and size of tippet to not spook fish.
We have a couple questions here on flies. Pete Gramp in Pottstown, Pennsylvania asks, the often asked yet never old question, if you had a limit on which flies you could fish, which are the top few that you would choose above any other fly?
Good question. And the reason I think that's such a great question is because, in my opinion, presentation is more important than fly selection, because if you can come close to matching the natural, if you have a presentation to where the fish is viewing your fly on a regular basis, and this is why sight fishing is so important, the fish are more willing to take the fly. And some of my go-to favorites are RS2 is an all-time great fly to use. I always have that in my box and will use it on a regular basis, weekly basis. John's Flies, John Barr, a good friend of mine, I have confidence in many of his patterns, including the Barr merger, the PMD, the Blueing Olive Barr merger, never go home without him, or never leave home without him. Copper John, same thing. Confidence Fly, you can match different colorations, different sizes. A stone fly I never go home without is a Prince Nymph. When in doubt, fish a Prince Nymph, and oftentimes Prince Nymphs for stone fly imitations will outfish a lot of the very popular and very effective patterns in the market today, but one of the great standby flies I've always used. And then a question I was asked today while we were on the water and fish started rising, my all-time go-to dry fly for midge adults is a Griffith's Gnat over any fly. And Griffith's Gnats are great because it mimics the legs of the insect while they're on the water surface. So when you're dealing with midges to where their wings lie flat on their back, the legs become the identifier. And one of the key things about many of my fly selections is that they're subtle with some flash or some coloration, but they're more natural looking than they are flash. So that becomes a key factor in knowing that it's drifting through the run and, again, becomes a natural view for the fish.
James Boyd says he recently saw you at Hook Fly Shop in Littleton, Colorado. He says your presentation was really good. If you had 6 flies to use for the spring runoff, what would you use and what type, color, and size? And he's talking about specifically South Platte and 11 Mile Canyon.
Sure.
Favorites with him?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my favorites right now that we used today was a flashback Blueing Olive Barr merger, a Mercury Pheasant Tail we used today, a Black Rojo Midge is another one of my favorite. Craven's Jujube Midge is another favorite. Eggs work as well. The water increases. The thing about eggs, people always associate eggs with spring and fall and running and spawning fish, but eggs become an important food source when there's a large abundance in the water. And what really causes that in Colorado is an increase in flow. So eggs is something to always have in your box, but only fish them when the flows are increased, and often fish them in the deeper runs where they're being washed down into deep water and fish can feed on them. In addition to that, Slump Buster, one of my favorite streamers to use, and the second streamer would be Mike Lawson's Conehead Sculpin. Those are pretty much a lot of flies that I love to use during the spring.
Terrific, terrific. Daniel in Lake Havasu City, Arizona asks, when sight fishing for trout and seeing swirls just below the surface, where trout are feeding on emergers, I guess feeding through emergers, would you fish an individual dry fly or emerger with a trailing chuck, or use a dropper with both emerger and dry?
I would do a dry dropper, and what I would do in those situations is if the fish is willing to take the emerger, continue fishing the emerger below a dry so you have a visual to where you can follow your rig as it drifts downstream to the swirls. In addition to that, you can also do something called the dead swing, where the beginning of the drift is drag-free, and at the end of the drift, you let everything swing to where even your dry fly is also drowning and sinking in the run with your emerger. A lot of times fish that are eating emergers are eating flies that are hatching or moving to the surface, or they're eating flies that are dead and are being flushed down below the water surface.
Okay. JP in Ohio asks, you're targeting trophy trout. Do you use sinking tip or full sinking lines? Also, are streamers used as the majority of the time? I think he's talking about for the really real big trout. So.
Yeah, I use streamers probably, I would say, 20% of the time, depending on conditions. And my two favorite streamer conditions are cloudy days, stormy days, any bad weather situation, or dirty water, where flows are increased and trout are harder to spot because fish will disperse amongst the water. And as you're moving up and downstream and covering large sections of water, fishing streamers in those situations, more trout will see your flies. So I think that's a huge part in using streamers and being effective on the water with them.
Okay. And he had asked about, do you use sinking tip or sinking lines?
You bet. And the sink tip and sinking lines, I prefer sink tip in situations where I'm dealing with tailwaters, and I will use sinking lines. I usually start with a 200-grain sinking line and go to 300-grain. In situations I'll use those is where I'm dealing with large, vast, deep runs to where I want to make sure my flies stay directly on the bottom. that typically is when the fish are staging. So if I'm dealing with staging trout is when I'll use a sink tip or a sinking line so I can keep it down deep where the fish are resting or sulking. And beyond that, I'll use an actual leader with a floating line and just to get my weight from the fly itself.
And when you're going that deep, I'm assuming you probably can't see the fish. It's more of a blind presentation.
It can be a blind presentation, and you can also see the fish. I'd say 50-50 on that. If you can see the fish deep down in the run or you can see the make of the fish, then that's where you oftentimes be using the floating lines. For sink tip lines or full sink lines, if you can't see the fish down deep in the water, that's where you'd be swinging through and just trying to make sure your presentation is covering the depth of the water where the trout's holding.
Jack in Collegeville asks, how often are you using indicators when nymphing to visible trout? I fish a lot of limestoners where the fish are extra spooky. Any tips for getting into position to cast? Are you generally fish down or up to them? So I have a couple of questions there.
Sure. First question, indicators. I use indicators probably 30% of the time. The reason I'll use, well, maybe I should say 40% of the time. The reason I'll use an indicator is when I'm dealing with deep water. And an indicator, in my opinion, should be called a suspender. Because what I'm really trying to do is suspend my flies to where they're floating at a certain depth. So when I'm suspending flies in a deep run, I'll use indicators. The rest of the time, instead of using an indicator, I'll use different weight of the flies. When you're dealing with that, an example would be in shallow water, instead of using a brass or metal bead or a tungsten bead, for shallow water situations, use plastic beads to where you get depth, but it's not too deep to where you're going to snag the river bottom. For mid-column, use metal or brass beads, and for deep water, use tungsten beads. That way you know you're controlling your depth at the same time you're able to get adrift. And when you're dealing with limestone and wary trout, which you'll see in Pennsylvania or Spring Creeks or many different waters where the fish are very spooky, when you're making presentations and getting into position, walking wide, like we had mentioned before, is key to where you move upstream. My favorite way to present to trout that are very wary and spooky is from above the fish. The reason is everything, again, is out of view. There's no casting. There's no movement. And the first thing visible to the trout is your fly. One thing to always remember, too, is when you're dealing with spooky fish, whenever you cast, the wicking moisture off your fly line creates a huge disturbance on the water surface in addition to the landing of the line itself. So always try to make your distance and practice cast above the fish or below the fish so that it's out of view and there's no disturbance on the water where you're going to present your fly to the fish.
Very good, very good. Question here coming off the Internet. Chris in Lakewood, Colorado says, when sight fishing, I seem to foul hook more fish. It's frustrating and harmful to the fish. Any tips for limiting this?
Absolutely, and that's a great topic to bring up. When you're fouling fish, what's happening a lot of the times is you're casting above the trout and you're trying to make an accurate presentation. And if the fish isn't willing to feed or is willing to feed, the flies are bumping into the fish or they're rubbing the trout. One way to eliminate that, and what I do when I make presentations and I try to show and teach my clients, is to think short of the trout. So when you get to the point where you're comfortable with accuracy, you can be short of the fish by 6 inches, or you can be short of the fish by a foot to where the flies are drifting to the side of the trout by 6 inches or 12 inches, making sure that your trailing fly is not going to rub the fish's body. The advantage to that is you know every drift that you make when it's floating downstream will be visible to the trout. At the same time, you're not going to spook the fish. And it also lets you know more times how the fish feed and when they feed because the trout will have to make a movement when it comes over to consume your fly.
Okay, Greg in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Basically, I'll just, again, paraphrase his question. Do you believe low-pressure system or the barometric pressure has an effect on fishing? What would be the barometric pressure that would result in trout feeding or not feeding?
I believe it plays a part. I don't think it's as much of a factor as, for example, when you're dealing with bass, but I often find that we don't really go into details on specific readings because we deal with so many storm conditions. I base it more on what activity and what results I see when storms come through or when storms pass. Before a storm, as the storm system's moving in, fish become very active. And when the storm hits, they tend to shut down. The best fishing we find is often after the storm. When things go back to normal, the pressure rises, the fish begin to feed more heavily. During the storm systems themselves, the fish tend to sulk, hold down on the bottom, and they won't be as active as they are prior or post-storm, which post-storm would be the best time frame.
Coming off the Internet, we have a couple of questions here. And I'm going to kind of combine these because we've got Rod in Amarillo, Texas. He asks, what are the main keys to success once you have found and sighted your trophy trout? And then Karen in Los Angeles asks, any rules of thumb for beginners? And I think maybe you can kind of tie those together.
Absolutely. For beginners, first thing definitely is always look before you fish. And in addition to that is simplify all of your approaches, presentations, every technique that you use. That's one of the things we do as guides is we try to simplify the techniques and how we teach. If you simplify it and how you learn, as you progress in this industry, every time you learn something, you'll make it a step-by-step process to where you'll be able to learn it faster, teach it to others, and become more successful. And what was the second question, Roger?
Well, Rod was asking, what are your main keys to success once you have found and sighted your trophy trout? And I think that was probably important to a beginner as well.
Oh, absolutely. The main key to success, in my opinion, is the technique I refer to as the dotted line, to where you're casting your flies above the trout by an imaginary line that you make upstream. Once your flies land, the key there is to make sure that you're basing the splash or the land of the flies, not the indicator of fly line. And when your flies are drifting down to the trout, this goes into the question we had before, your flies are naturally drifting back towards you at an angle towards the bank you're standing on. So they're sweeping through the run. They're not sinking directly down to the bottom. And when that happens, when you're drifting to the fish and you cast above the trout, compensate by knowing if you cast a foot past the dotted line, the natural drift back towards you, the flies are going to pass across the trout's viewing lane and then drift down short of the trout by 6 to 12 inches. Using the dotted line technique like that has been huge. And in addition to that, when you set the hook, the biggest problem many anglers have with trophy trout is the hook set. I prefer calling it a lift because by setting the hook, you're applying a lot of power and you're continuing to apply power. If you lift on the fish, you're applying power to a fly that's already penetrated the trout's mouth. You're just reassuring the placement of the fly. So a smooth lift, and as soon as you feel the power, the tension of the fish, allow the trout to do its first reactions, which is often a head shake followed by a run, and then begin the fight. Those are some of the common things I see that people develop and enhance their skills on and become better at landing trophy fish.
Rich in Cleveland asks, how many different flies do you try in a given area? How does fly selection factor into how you work an area?
Fly selection factors into the area I'm fishing based on the insects at hand during the season. For example, today, we started my trip out today with my clients in slow, slack-moving water just above 11 Mile Reservoir. And because there wasn't a lot of current there, what I ended up doing was fishing streamers because we could cast to the other side of the river at an upstream angle, strip the flies back to us. And a lot of the fish that first come out of the reservoir are used to eating bait fish. So I know that those fish are keen in on bait fish in 11 Mile, and because they're only half a mile into the river system, that would still be a familiar food source. And as we moved upstream in the afternoon, we switched over and started fishing midges, and I used midge larvae at the morning time because the water conditions were not warm enough to suffice a hatch. Once I started seeing midges flying around in the air, then I switched over and started using emergers and had more success using those throughout the course of the day.
Another question from Rod in Amarillo, Texas. I have a problem in hooking fish downstream. Any tips on hooking up?
Well, absolutely. When you're setting the hook downstream, try to imagine a dotted line that's parallel or directly in line with your shoulder. So if you were to spread your arms out to the side, that's the imaginary line from your shoulder going downstream. When you set downstream, always make sure to stop your hand before it reaches that plane of your shoulder. If you break your wrist and the rod tip or your arm and hand breaks the plane of your shoulder, you won't be able to compensate by allowing your arm to drop when the fish pulls back. So you've reached the maximum flex of your rod. which puts all the pressure on your leader and tippet and results in trout breaking off. So if you can stop before the plane your shoulder, if the fish does a head shake or runs, you can allow them to pull your arm to a front part of your body and compensate and make the adjustments on whatever the trout's movements are.
Terrific, terrific. Well, one more question, because we're running out of time here. It's from Rick in Southeast Pennsylvania. And Rick asks, what's the craziest thing you had to do to land your client's trophy fish?
The craziest thing I've had to do to land a client's trophy fish, and wasn't a client, a paying customer, it was a friend of mine, but helping him land his fish is I, 2 years ago, did a trip up to the Arctic Circle in Alaska in pursuit of some of the largest char in the world. And as we flew into Anchorage, my luggage made its way to California. So I was without my gear as far as waders and boots. When we arrived at the location in Kotzebue before we took our bush plane up to the location where we were going to camp for a week, we could only stand sitting around for 6 hours. So they ended up dropping us off on the river. And when they took off, they were going to bring my gear in a second flight as soon as it arrived at their office. When we got out, we set up camp, we set up tent, and the hardest thing to do in the world is to set up camp, knowing that there's thousands of fish that are 20 feet away from you, so that was hard enough. But as I was setting up camp, my friend ended up wading up, moving upstream, and immediately hooked into a fish, which happened to be one of the largest char of the trip, but there's nobody around, so what I had to do was go in after the fish with pants on, insulated pants, boots, and socks, and it was the worst pain I've ever felt to my feet in my entire life. And it ended up moving across stream and helped him land the fish. And as he got the fish in and was screaming from excitement, I was on the bank screaming because my feet were on fire. But the end result was we were able to get the quality char, and that one I think was 35 inches long and weighed close to 18 pounds. So it was great to see the reward for him, but definitely the craziest situation I've been in. And I can honestly say now that I have wet-weighted in the Arctic Circle.
Good for you. I don't think anybody will want to duplicate that effort, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Well,
don't blame them.
Unfortunately, we're out of time here, and we need to wrap things up, but don't go away just quite yet. We're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and we're also going to be giving away a copy of Landon's book, Sight Fishing for Trout. So hang tight here and see if you win. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on, and it's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn about how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or call 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Well, just a reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on the homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. Now it's time to give away our prizes. And the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database, so if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but be sure you do for the next show so you don't miss out on some of these great prizes we have to give away. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show by email and provide you with information on how to receive your gifts. So first, we're going to give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. To learn more about the FFF, go to fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. And our winner of that one-year membership is Danny Buchanan in California. Danny Buchanan in California. And, pardon?
Hey, congratulations.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm sure he'll enjoy that. And if any of our winners already have a membership. We'll get that extended for you and get you taken care of. Now, to find out more about the Fed Fly Fishers, you can go to fedflyfishers.org. Learn about that organization. It's a great one to help support, even if you didn't win tonight. And our next thing that we're going to give away is a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. You can learn more about Fly Fusion at flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And a great magazine out of Calgary, Canada. Great photography, great how-tos, and a wonderful subscription to have. And our winner for that is Lloyd Berkey. Lloyd Berkey. And congratulations to Lloyd on that. Lloyd lives in Pennsylvania. So enjoy that subscription, Lloyd, and I'm sure you will. Now, okay, giveaway Landon's book, Sight Fishing for Trout. I want to thank you, Landon, for offering that up tonight. Surely appreciate
You're welcome.
Stack Pole Books. And everybody enjoyed your last book, so I'm sure this next book is dynamite, too. So
I hope it helps many anglers be successful in the water.
Yeah, great, great. Well, I have to come up with a question here, and here's my question. When we were talking about presentation, there was a time when Landon talked about moving, if you're looking at a fish upstream, and that if you couldn't do a hook or circle cast, that the best position would be to be certain degrees off from the feeding lane of the fish. How many degrees should you move to the side of that feeding lane to the fish? I hope I described that well enough for somebody to get the answer. And I'm looking for it. Oh, I think we might have a winner, but I'm going to check with you, Landon.
Mm-hmm.
We have an answer that says 45 degrees. Is that the correct answer?
That's correct.
Okay, Pete Sesko, Wethersfield, Connecticut. You just won Landon's book, so congratulations, Pete. And good for you for paying attention. So what you got to do, Pete, is send us either in that same text box your address and contact information. That would be helpful to have your email address and phone in case we have any issues. But be sure to give us your shipping address, and then Landon will personalize that book and send it directly to you. So great congratulations and wonderful, wonderful prize to give away tonight. Well, Landon, hey, thanks for being with us again. It's a pleasure to talk with you again. I enjoyed it the last time and enjoyed it this time, and this tonight was... You just gave away the farm tonight, Landon. It was a lot of good information. So I hope people will learn from it and put it and apply it immediately.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you for having me on. And I do believe that teaching is the way that this sport's going to grow and people will become more successful in the water. So that's my hopes for our interview. So thanks again for having me.
You're welcome. And thanks for being with us. Our next podcast will be on March 17th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we'll interview Paul Bruin, and our topic for the show will be cutthroat on the Upper Snake River. Paul Bruin has fly fished and guided on the Upper Snake River for over 35 years. His understanding of his home waters and the native cutthroat trout are second to none. Listen in to learn about fly fishing this incredible water for an incredible fish. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Royal Gorge Anglers, Keeney's Fly Shop, Front Range Anglers, and the Platte River Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.